It's Thursday, March 28th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Okay, here's a little quiz. What activity do you engage in, probably every day, that has a 95% fail rate? 95% of your effort is wasted. Oh, we all do things that it takes a while to see the results, right? We go to the gym that only shows up over time, or Duolingo, or, to be more abstract, loving one's children. It doesn't always come back to you in the moment. But a 95% fail rate, 19 out of 20 efforts are for naught, and you do it every day. Now, I remember there were those lines for tickets, probably still are, popular Broadway shows. And my sister, when she was younger, she'd stand in line. You didn't always get a ticket, but every once in a while, like I think every two or three, maybe three or four times, she'd get a ticket for Rent for $20, day of, right? I remember she went once, she went twice. I'm like, is this so wise? Then she went again and she got the tickets. If she'd gone 19 times, I'd say, you gotta stop, Lauren. This is a huge waste of time. So what is this 95% fail rate activity? It is revealed here in this report on the PBS NewsHour that they did 2 weeks ago.
On average, the world produces 430 million metric tons of plastic every year. The United States alone produces tens of millions of tons of plastic waste annually. Yet, on average in the United States, only about 5 to 6% of plastic is recycled.
I know it was bad. I knew it was a lot of plastics that weren't recycled. I suspected most plastics we quote-unquote recycle don't actually get recycled. But 5%? Oh, I know all the arguments. Come on, it's not so onerous. What does it cost you? How much effort does it take? I'll tell you how much effort. Some effort. Some 95% wasted effort. You know, I have a piano. And I don't play it. I used to play it. I had one goal. I wanted to learn how to play Werewolves of London on the piano. We had a little more time. I played the piano. And then we did work in the house. It lasted 6 months. I put a lot of stuff up against the piano. I couldn't get to it, and I haven't played it. Well, I'll tell you this. I should get back to playing the piano, but I really don't have time. But if you could tell me, Mike, you have 5 minutes a day, or you have 25 minutes a week, and you could get down and you could bang out the Werewolves of London, I bet after a couple weeks that I could play Werewolves of London. I'll tell you something else. I don't call my parents enough. They're getting old. They are old. They're not getting younger. All those things are true. 20, 25 more minutes a week to talk to my parents. Yeah, I could. I know I could do that while recycling, but not really. It's too loud on the phone. So I'll take 20 or 25 minutes, and you would too, in so many aspects of your life. Instead, we waste it on the recycling of plastics that don't get recycled. The report that they were talking about on the NewsHour mostly focused on the lies of the plastic industry. They knew it wasn't going to do much, but they lied about it. But so what? They're supposed to lie. It's our elected officials who are supposed to confront the lies of industry and say, no, those are lies. Instead, they put in laws that made us recycle, that made us continue this charade. I really want to stop participating in recycling. I think we should all stop participating. We aren't actually stopping participating. Actually doing it is not participating at a 95% fail rate. I call for a plastic strike. Oh, I know all the people who love the earth a lot more than I do would say it would be horrible and harmful. 5%. We're talking about 5%. 5% is nothing. 95%, that's something. That's what you could see from space. That's the big pile of plastic we're not recycling. If we all had a recycling strike, what would happen? The plastic would pile up. There'd be societal concern. We'd say, we have to do something about it. And then if someone came up with a solution and said, well, I have this program, and this solution would only leave 95% of the problem unaddressed, that person would be chased out of town, maybe pelted with bullets. Rubber bullets, unrecyclable rubber bullets, but you get my point. The solution to the problem, were it were to confront us, would not be the non-solution we're living with now. So join me. Do not recycle. Or as we call the process of washing the plastics, sorting the plastics, bagging the plastics, putting the plastics out for collection, the name for that process should be not recycling, because that's what we're doing. We're not recycling. Margin of error, 5 or 6%, we're possibly negative recycling. I know once I join in this civic protest, and if you don't join with me, it won't be a collective. I'll be out on my own fine. I know, speaking of fine, I could be fined. I looked it up. In my municipality, it's a fine of $50. I vow to pay $250. On the show today, I spiel about Trump stock and Trump wealth. One's not so real. The other is sadly pretty real. But first, Anthony Fowler is a professor of political science in the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago. He researches political polarization. So do I. The credibility of empirical research. If it's empirical, it's credible. But what about the research that claims to be empirical? He is the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Journal of Political Science, and he's the author of Thinking Clearly with Data. I listen to him on Not Another Politics Podcast. Pretty good. It's like a lot of other politics podcasts, but also not. It's a great conversation. I really like the guy. And we will talk about politics, how to know what we know, and the presidential election. Anthony Fowler up next.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi: People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
I'm Dr. Megan Sachs.
And I'm Dr. Amy Sloshberg.
And we're the host of the podcast Campus Killings. Our show covers some of the most sinister crimes to take place on or around school campuses, or the cases we discuss have a school-connected theme.
And with the new school year comes an all-new second season of Campus Killings, which will debut on September 16th, 2023.
But if you want to listen to Campus Killings now, you can binge all the episodes from season one, available everywhere you listen to podcasts.
So if you listen to the show enough, you know that, you know, basically where my politics stand and what my analysis of policy is. Maybe I think I have articulated what I think politics should be for, which is to do the most for the most people while giving the most attention to the people who need politics the most. Okay, good. Very pithy. However, there's this really strange situation that I find our country in for the first time ever, which is that the people who are least engaged in politics not just are going to swing elections, that, or at least that notion of that is true. You hear that when people talk about, oh, it's only 80,000 people in six swing states that the entire presidential election is about. I'm not exactly making that point. The point that I want to make is, it seems to me, and this is subjective, that the people who pay not the least, but really, really a moderate amount of attention to politics are right. They actually have the best policy prescriptions. Broadly speaking, their wisdom cuts through the extremes of partisanship that have begun to characterize our politics, our parties, our media. Well, I can't think of anyone better to throw these opinions to and bounce things off of than Anthony Fowler. He's a professor in the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago. His podcast, it's kind of another politics podcast. No, it's not. The name of it is Not Another Politics Podcast. It's really good. We have some of the same ideas about the boogeyman of polarization, but some not. Anthony Fowler, welcome to The Gist.
Thank you so much, Mike, for having me. I'm honored to be here. I'm a fan of The Gist, and I'm completely surprised and flattered that you're a fan of None of the Politics Podcast. So thank you so much.
Oh, it's really good. I always have a political science podcast in the mix, sometimes two, and yours is definitely high on the list. I won't, you know, divulge that I've gone away from the Niskanen Center, but let's just leave that where it is. What about my premise? Have you thought about this, that the most engaged are the most extreme, and not the least engaged? I'm not talking about non-voters, but people who have a real moderate amount of engagement in politics perhaps are the hope and can lead the way?
I think you're absolutely right as a purely predictive or correlational matter. I think as a causal question, if, say, somebody who is hyper-informed became less informed, would they become more reasonable or vice versa?
No, right, exactly.
Although they might.
There is a brain disease element to some of this hyper-information. And also a social
possible.
Element, right?
Yes.
You feel like you have to interact with your fellows.
Right.
But
I think there's a big group of moderates out there. They're in the middle. They're unhappy with what they're seeing in Washington. They're unhappy with both parties. Maybe as a result, they're just less likely to engage in politics, less likely to become hyper-informed. They're not talking about politics on social media and so forth. And they are probably the ones with the most sensible, reasonable views. They are important in democracy. They're just not the voices we hear all the time.
They're least likely to view politics as entertainment, which is probably a good thing. Although if it were a complete thing, my show and your show, I guess, wouldn't exist. But it is kind of weird, isn't it, in that I'm not just saying that they're going to decide where the country goes. I do think that there is a wisdom to them, and they don't fall into some of the traps that have really gotten our politics stuck. Or do you think, and you'll be able to diagnose this, do you think I'm engaging in the some sort of heuristic about the rectitude of middle America and, you know, the average man?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think this is a topic of big debate among political scientists. Who are these people in the middle? Are they, you know, do they look like they're in the middle just because they're disengaged and don't have any real opinions? Are they closet partisans and so forth? There are these debates. And my view, after looking at a lot of different evidence from a lot of different angles, is that no, they really are genuinely pretty moderate. They're sensible. They have reasonable views. They're not irrational. They're not crazy. They just happen to be in the middle. You could have thought about the issue and just happen to think the minimum wage should be $12, which happens to be a view that no member of Congress would espouse.
Right.
But a totally reasonable person could have that view. And in fact, many of them do. And I think that's probably true as you go down the list. There's lots of issues like that. And so there's a big group of these people in the middle. They're just not happy with either party, but they're totally sensible. They're maybe not quite as informed and as engaged as the partisans for good reason, for understandable reasons, but they're not just tuned out, dumb flyover country people. They've thought about things and they have views that happen to be in the middle.
Yeah, yeah. They are civically engaged, even if they're not watching our, you know, two of our three main cable stations, which are sorted by party. But do you think, here's the weird thing. In what other walks of life do we find that those who are the least experienced or the least engaged are the best at it? Like with driving, the less you drive, it's not true that the safer the roads become. The same with surgery. So I take two things that are, you know, a little bit at the extremes of how much expertise you need and how much you don't. But it does seem like in every other walk of life, the more engagement, the better results, the better information you get. And I don't know if that's true with the American voter.
I mean, some of that is because there could just be actual learning through experience. That the more you drive, I hope the better you get at it. Although that probably varies in different contexts. In politics, there must be some of that. That you, in fact, the more experienced you are, the more exposed you are to different arguments, the better you are at reasoning through political issues and so forth. But there's also this big selection problem, which is, people who are in the middle, who are kind of unhappy with both political sides, they just have less incentive to get really engaged and get really informed and get that experience. Whereas it's the people who have extreme views are the ones that are the most worked up. I'm sure there are other domains that are like that. Although very often the selection probably works in the other direction, where, you know, the people who are most interested in playing basketball are the people who are naturally gifted at basketball. But in the case of politics, it's not necessarily skill that we're selecting on. We're selecting on just kind of extremism of your ideology, which is a different thing.
Does the data show that the people who are moderate and maybe not watching the two cable channels are just as informed as the people who are?
they're less informed. They are less informed. So if you just ask kind of factual questions, you know, who's the Secretary of State, or so, you know, which party's in control of Congress, people in the middle are less likely to know the answer to those questions than people on the extremes.
Yeah. I can't defend that. At first I was telling a story to myself, well, maybe they're less informed about the ins and outs of what Alejandro Mayorkas is said to have done to get impeachment. And probably the best way forward in that is, what are you talking about? Same with Hunter Biden, like some of the things that dominate political media. But if they don't know the Secretary of State, well, I don't know. Maybe I could talk myself out of it. Yeah. Is it so important to be able to name?
Yeah. I don't think so. But I mean, those are we ask very simple factual questions, like, you know, which party's in control of Congress? We don't ask questions like, you know, what do you think the different arguments would be in the Supreme Court if this issue came to, you know, they might be better at actually, you know, being able to imagine competing arguments for things and think through difficult policy questions than strong ideologues are.
Yeah, I think we're kind of, I'm going to throw this out there, and I know this is going to cause you discomfort because you haven't actually seen the data. But here's a theory. Maybe we're seeing some of that on, say, the abortion question. A lot of polling. It's not that people were totally uninformed on abortion. But if you ask them questions using some of the phrasing or jargon of the people who are most informed, they wouldn't be able to recognize it, right? They might not be able to say the words Roe versus Wade, right? They might not know that that was the controlling decision by the Supreme Court. Does that mean that they're less wise? Does that actually mean they're less informed in the way it matters, which is why we have a democracy? Like, let's represent the will of the people. What's the will of the people? Oh, we're seeing that they don't want abortion illegalized after 6 weeks.
I agree. It's not obvious at all that the kind of factual knowledge that you can get from Wikipedia is what's really important for a thriving democracy. What you want is people to have reasoned views. They don't all have to have the same views. That's actually one of the great virtues of democracy, is we can all live with each other without having the same views. I hear people complain all the time, like, oh, democracy is in peril because people are disagreeing so much. I think that's a reason to love democracy, is that we can live with each other and govern without agreeing with each other. But I think, you know, I think the better measures of, can you reason through a tricky political issue and can you decide which candidate is likely better for your interests, that's a harder thing to measure. And there's no reason to think that people in the middle are worse at doing that than ideologues are.
Yeah. So I'll tell you a little bit about my priors, which is probably, every time you say it on the show, you should ring a bell or put a quarter in the tip jar priors. I graduated college in 1994. I was a political science major, and a Stanford professor named Morris Fiorina was very influential. He wrote a book to me. He wrote a book called One Nation After All, I think it was called. And his whole point was, look at all these polls. We're told we're polarized in political extremes. And by the way, this was 1994, when the polarization was like Gingrich and Clinton. We're told we're in political extremes, but look at all this polling. We're really not. And I believe that. I believe that for a long time. Of course, I had another professor. These are names I'm sure you know. Alan Abramowitz at Emory. He sort of said the other thing. And he was my professor, and I liked him very much. But maybe I wanted to believe the Fiorina One Nation Under All thing. And then for 20 years, including a lot of time as a political reporter, I came to believe that Morris was wrong. And now here you come along, essentially picking up the Morris Fiorina mantle, saying, we're really more One Nation After All. You wrote an op-ed in Newsweek, America's Silent Majority is Alive and Well and More Moderate Than Either Party. Tell me what I should think about the intellectual legacy of Morris Fiorina.
Sure. I mean, Fiorina and Abramowitz are both excellent political scientists. I know the debate well. The big disagreement comes about is about how we should be measuring polarization. So if you just measure polarization as the average difference between self-identified Democrats and Republicans, then it is true that for many issues, there has been a bit of an increase. And that's what, you know, Abramowitz has pointed that out. And a lot of that is actually because of increased sorting. So for whatever reason, Democrats and Republicans have increasingly sorted themselves ideologically. But if instead you just try to measure polarization as kind of some sense of the distribution of ideology, have people actually gotten further apart? Are there more extremists? Or are things more polarized in that sense, that there's more people on the polls? And Fiorina is right to point out that for most issues, that hasn't happened. And so if you just look at a distribution of ideology, you get usually, you know, if you look at minimum wage or tax rates or other things you can measure on a continuous scale, you tend to get a kind of unimodal distribution. It looks kind of like a normal Gaussian curve with most people somewhere in the middle. Most people well to the right of, you know, of Nancy Pelosi and well to the left of Mitch McConnell. And you don't get, you know, you don't get these two polls like you would get if you looked at members of Congress. And it just so happens that Democrats and Republicans self-sort themselves so that, yes, the average Republican is notably more conservative than the average Democrat. And on some issues that might have increased over time. But that doesn't mean that there's more extremists in the general population than there used to be. I'll also add one more bit of, you know, one more wrinkle, which is that we tend to fixate on the most salient political issues of the day. And when an issue becomes less polarized, we stop talking about it. So gay marriage is an issue where we've seen depolarization, but we just stop talking about that issue and we ignore that. But we should take a second to say, hey, wait, this was the thing that used to really divide us. And now most of us agree on this. And that's a good thing, but we kind of ignore that and we say, oh, look at how polarized we are, because here we are debating now the new issue of the day where we're divided.
Right, right. And, you know, just maybe pat ourselves on the back or thank our lucky stars that we're not one of these Shia Sunni divided communities. We don't, so on most of the big things, we mostly agree, as opposed to a lot of other countries in the world. And let me just say, even though I was a political science major, the Gaussian curve, let us call it the bell curve for our purposes and our audience. Yes, same thing?
Sure, that's
okay,
fine.
Very good. Okay. Okay, so to what, Fiorina, Abramowitz, to what does Fowler contribute to this body of knowledge?
Well, I mean, I'm trying to contribute in a few different ways. I'm studying both the elite polarization and public polarization, and there is a very big disconnect. So the elites are indeed quite polarized. It's hard to find a moderate member of Congress who's actually anywhere near the average American on most policy issues. Whereas the public...
Say that again. It's hard to find a member of Congress who's anything
right.
Like a
right.
Moderate American? Okay.
I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, there are some rare exceptions. We know of the relatively moderate members of Congress. But even, you know, even Joe Manchin would be, you know, pretty far to the left of most Americans on most issues. But he's the rare exception. But if you pick your typical member of Congress, if they're a Democrat, they're going to be well to the left of the median voter, even in their district. Even among self-identified Democrats in their district, and the typical Republican is going to be well to the right. So there's that big disconnect. So I'm studying that in a number of different ways, looking at roll call voting in Congress, looking at historical data, and then also trying to match that up with survey data, measures of public opinion, and coming up with clever research designs to understand why is there such a disconnect.
Mm-hmm. Just to interrupt. Now, are they're to the left in the ways that matter, their public policy positions and what they vote for, but is it that the parties are, you know, Democrats very to the left, Republicans very to the right, if you go by the sort of data that you people cull, to be a member of such a party in good standing and not to immolate your political chances by literally going independent, which we've seen in some examples, you have to just adopt so many of the positions, so many of the votes that you get coded as pretty much to the left or to the right just to be a member of a party.
I think that is a big part of it. I think the party leaders do exercise a lot of influence over rank and file members. And they, you know, they control committee assignments, they control campaign resources and so forth. And there's probably also just some fear that even if electorally it's good for you to moderate, there's some fear that you're alienating yourself with your party leadership and it could be bad for your long-term career and so forth. And there are, you know, even at the lower level, I think there are a lot of people you don't know of, your local county party chair who helps to recruit candidates and helps dole out campaign resources, they're probably exercising a lot of influence behind the scenes and saying, hey, if you don't say X, Y, and Z, we're not going to give you money, we're not going to support you. So I'm sure that's a big part of the story. And and there's some work documenting the influence of party leaders. It does seem like a big part of the story. And party leaders, by the way, have also gotten more extreme over time. And some of that probably is because of geographic polarization, where there's, you know, increasingly, if to be an experienced member, a Democrat in Congress, you're probably from an urban area. You're probably a Chuck Schumer or a Nancy Pelosi representing a place that's not very representative of the rest of the country. So I suspect leaders are a big part of it. But I think even before you get there, I think there's a big selection problem of who even decides to run for office to begin with. I think most of the polarization is coming from that. Most of it is that the kind of people who want to run for office are already so much more extreme than the general public.
They think of politics as a place for them, whereas the solution makers who are maybe in the middle rationally say, oh, why would I want to dedicate my efforts to that particular sphere?
I think that's right. And I think that's totally reasonable. I don't want to be in Congress, by the way. I'm sure you don't either. And lots of, if I just asked a bunch of smart, competent, moderate people who say have other things to do, they're partners at law firms or they're, you know, successful business people, et cetera, they would say, of course, I don't want to run for office. It's terrible. I've spent all my time raising money. I don't actually have that much influence. Maybe I'll be one of many legislators and I'll have to go along with the party line or I won't get anything done and so forth. So I think that's a huge part of the problem.
So wait, you've done a lot of research on the effect of money in politics, right?
I've done some, yes. And I think maybe surprisingly, a lot of the evidence suggests that money doesn't distort things as much as you might think. So I think people would be surprised to hear that. But although I do think fundraising expectations change who's willing to run for office. So
yeah, that's what I was getting at. When you articulated this, all these, you know, smart people at a law firm who aren't that into Congress or running for Congress because they're essentially in the middle, it seems like you're hinting at, oh, maybe there's the potential for the moneyed class to turn our politics more moderate. But as you just said, yeah, except money doesn't really do that.
That seems to be right. I think most of these members of Congress and other elected officials, they're ideologues. It's hard to find any evidence that would significantly change their behavior. They're not that responsive to electoral incentives in terms of their ideological positions, how they cast their roll call votes. And so it'd be preposterous to imagine that a $3,000 contribution from some corporate PAC would magically change how they're voting on important legislation.
So people who run for Congress are ideologues. The parties are more ideological. The party leaders are more ideological. But we've also heard that the parties have become so much less powerful. And it's no longer the case that the party decides who the candidate is or much of anything else. And people can become free agents and raise money outside of the parties. Isn't there then a market inefficiency that should suggest that more people can get elected who are moderate, who could just eschew the party system and survive on their own?
Absolutely. In fact, almost all of the evidence suggests that on average, all else equal, more moderate candidates do better in elections. In general elections, you know, and there's a bunch of different ways you can try to study this. One clever approach taken by Andy Hall at Stanford is let's look at close primary elections between a relatively moderate and a relatively extreme candidate. When the relatively extreme candidate wins the primary election, that party performs notably worse in the general election.
Yeah.
So even if you yourself are an extremist voter, you're probably better off supporting a moderate in the primary because you're more likely to get the party that.
So we are fading our conversation here. It was a great one with Fowler. I think a great almost 20 minutes. We got a great extra number of minutes. And I ask you, should you wish to join us in that? Pesca Plus members will have access to the rest of the long conversation. They pay a small monthly fee. I think it's like $10. They don't get ads. If you don't want to hear the longer stuff but also don't want ads, we got a price tier for that. And access to other fun stuff. To subscribe, go to subscribe.mikepesca.com.
There are over 90,000 people missing at any time, and over 500,000 are reported missing every year. And that's just in the United States. I'm Mike Morford.
And I'm Jess Betancourt. And in our podcast, Missing Persons, we discuss cases of people who have gone missing under mysterious circumstances. And we're joined in each episode by guests who are either related to the missing person, investigating their disappearance, or advocating for answers in the case.
Missing Persons is available everywhere you listen to podcasts, and there are dozens of episodes to binge on right now. Subscribe today so you don't miss an episode.
And now the spiel. Past performance is no indication of future gains, and my stock analysis should not be construed as advice. But when it comes to one stock, despite recent highs, I would have to advise caution. Which stock? The BBC tells us.
Let me tell you that shares in Donald Trump's social media company have soared. As that company makes its formal debut on the stock market, shares pass $70 each. giving the firm a market value of more than $9 billion.
Again, I advise in investing in this particular one, caution. You know, caution, the word caution, the way I said caution, not alarming enough. How about caution, caution? The Truth Social Company had 2 days of excellent returns on the stock market. It's trading a little off today, about 62 when it closed. The actual company, the Truth Social Media site, has made about $3 million. $3 million in revenue last year. If you look at the books, it contains references to the legal bills of Donald J. Trump as business expenses, or at least expenses weighing down on business to watch out for. It has, well, it doesn't have a P.E. ratio because it doesn't have anything close to earnings. Now, to be fair, Amazon didn't have a P.E. ratio or earnings in the 90s. But, you know, that was a company that wanted to be the everything company. I think the Trump stock wants to, well, maybe be the dictator for a day company. A negative earnings sheet, a high price for the actual value of Truth Social, it just adds up to this being the ultimate meme stock. And with a meme stock, we say, oh, it can only go down. Yes, in the long term, but in the medium or short term, I don't know. I think Donald Trump could actually make a lot of money on this one. Because memes, stocks, like memes themselves, we always think of as ephemeral, cotton candy. But you know, a lot of memes last a long time. That surprise squirrel, he's been with us for almost a decade. The distracted boyfriend, he's been distracted for 7 years now. Those memes have staying power. In fact, the boyfriend has been distracted for so long, we can say he set about a generational record for attention span. That said, you will hear otherwise, actually not that said, like I said that, but now I'm talking about something else, back to the main thesis of the Trump stock. You will hear smart commentators saying, you got to short this stock. Joe Klein in his newsletter writes, I know nothing about markets, but here's a tip. Short this stock, it won't last. To that I say, caution. Okay, well, maybe not that much caution, but caution. I would not buy. I would not hold. But this is not a good stock to short. Oh, it will go down at some point, but maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, or for the rest of our lives, depending on lifespan. You know, it's not so easy to short a stock. You're competing with everyone else who wants to short a stock. People who wanted to short the stock when it was in SPAC form lost $158 million in 2024. It is expensive to short the Trump stock. You're basically saying, I think the people who are really, really, really into and beholden by Trump, really, really into and taken and beholden with Trump, I think they're going to give up. I don't know about that. The Trump stock and the Trump company is worth about $8 million on paper. Trump's share of it might be $6 million. And that's on paper, but it's not disappearing ink. It's not paper mache. That wealth has actual value, lots of value right now. Which brings me to one aspect of Trump's paper success that irks me. Well, it does irk me that a charlatan con man succeeds, although that kind of is the American story. But in this case, as with Trump Steaks, Vodka University, his victims are pretty willing, those investing in the stock. You won't get mad at anyone who invests in the stock and lose their money, right? But I'm more curious about the flat-out denial of Trump's success. The SPAC and the stock have done well. They, in fact, have. People who have invested in many of Trump's companies have not lost all their money. Isn't that crazy? People who buy Trump-branded apartments can sell those apartments and have at a premium, and the Trump name, in many cases, didn't hurt them. You want to say these things, these investment vehicles have gone well, have gone stupidly well? Fine. But Trump has done well in the world of business. I'm not going to say fairly or unfairly. Who does well in business fairly? He has done well. And yet, the denial of this fact is legion. There's the very popular anti-Trump podcast, The Midas Touch. Here they are talking about the stock just on Friday.
The Trump SPAC had a disastrous day on Wall Street on Friday, despite the headlines that the formal merger between the SPAC and the private company Trump Media was confirmed by the shareholders. The stock dropped almost 14%. It's now at $36.94 a share, in my opinion, still very overinflated. So why, if this merger was approved, did the stock take this nosedive on Friday?
Yeah, well, we know how the stock actually did when it was actually traded. And that episode was headlined, "Trump in shock," all caps, "as his stock quickly tanks," all caps, "after merger." Well, neither of those assertions were true. Couldn't tell if Trump was in shock and his stock didn't quickly tank. It's done very well for him and the company since then. But the audience very much wanted to hear that they were true. Then there was this Substack post by the left-wing opinion writer Noah Berlansky. "Trump is broke. That's bad news for the GOP." He writes, "It's fun to watch Donald Trump turn his pockets inside out and go crawling about on his belly looking for loose nickels." Yeah, but Trump's not broke. And Trump hawking sneakers, evidence that he's broke and desperate, it is no break from Trump's usual practice of hawking water, wine, casinos, election results. Trump is not broke. It might disappoint those of us who are disgusted by Trump, but it is simply not the case that he is broke. He is worth billions. That's worth. Worth isn't definitely easy to disentangle. He has access to hundreds of millions of dollars, right? Even the New York Times, I shouldn't say even the New York Times. The New York Times calculates it's $350 million. I've seen other credible sources putting it at a bit higher than that in stocks, in bonds, in liquid, or assets that he can get his hands on. Trump's enemies hate the claim that Trump is rich, but he is in fact rich. He is the richest president ever, including both Roosevelt, Hoover, whatever George Washington's holdings were worth in today's money. I am interested in what propels this genre of coverage. One word for it is wish casting. It seems very popular, but I think it gets at a deeper psychological need. We want our enemies to suffer. We want bad people to get their comeuppance. We want justice to prevail. I, however, think that it is wrong to turn to politics for that. You could turn to religion or fiction or your own personal life. That's not what we should look to politics for. Cynically, wish casting, telling the audience what they wish were true, it's a decent enough business model. The Midas Touch guys serve their audience an endless stream of the end is nigh coverage about Trump, and they've had great success with it. But if you want to take reality on reality's terms, the reality show president, Donald Trump, is rich. Venal, greedy, dishonest, con man, rich. By the way, since when did those negative attributes contradict rich? Be suspicious, I say, of claims that seem delightful, the most delightful about your political enemies. Especially when those claims are made time and time again and wind up not coming to pass or wind up not having any material bearing on the world. I have participated in and read so many stories and heard so many stories about how Trump can't fund his campaign or Trump couldn't fund his last campaign or Trump couldn't pay his bills. But if the opposite of those stories were reported, there'd be no material difference in anything having to do with the world of Donald Trump. A better explanation for why Trump stiffs vendors or lawyers or argues with the New York courts about having to pay a bond or whines on the extremely valuable Truth Social about his bills isn't that Trump can't pay. It's that he very much doesn't want to pay. And so far, it's working. He hasn't had to pay. My advice for the perennial but impervious to counter evidence argument that Trump is but one final blow from losing it all and being exposed is to stand back and recognize what the argument is doing. As with Trump himself and his investors in his new stock, what it's doing is selling you a bill of goods that you want to believe in, but that just doesn't square with the underlying accounting. And that's it for today's show. Corey Warra produces The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca's in charge of special projects for Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Lipson's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to AdvertiseCast.com/The Gist. Umpru, Gpru, Dupru, and thanks for listening.